Making a recipe that calls for butter? Make it better with European butter from France. With a minimum of 82% butterfat, it's no wonder French butter is the number one choice for chefs the world over. Whether you're whipping up an omelet, sauteing vegetables, or spreading it on toast, the rich, cultured flavor of butter from France always elevates. Be sure to look for Made in France on the label, and for recipes, tips, and tricks, go to tasteeurope.com.
When I was younger, I used to be a contributor to Travel and Leisure. I remember at one point flying business on Cathay Pacific to Hong Kong, staying at the Peninsula, not just in any room, but in the telescope suite where there's this giant telescope that looks out into the skyline from Kowloon, and then having a Rolls-Royce Phantom drive me to the airport. I mean, it was bananas.
You're listening to The Taste Podcast. I'm Editor-in-Chief Matt Rodbard, here with Senior Editor Anna Hiesel.
Today, Matt is talking with Gary Steingart, a prolific novelist and food writer who's written New York Times bestselling books, including The Russian Debutante's Handbook, Super Sad True Love Story, and his most recent work, Our Country Friends.
Man, I'm such a fan of Gary Steingart, and I've wanted to have him on the show for a long time, and it was such a pleasure to have him in our studio. We talked about how he writes about food in his fiction, the way he textures the writing with real home cooking victories and annoyances, and what he enjoys cooking at home. We also talk about all of the restaurants he loves in New York City, and we talk about 90s New York and some of the great restaurants we've long forgotten, including the great Florent in the Meatpacking District.
Here's Matt talking with Gary.
Gary Steingart, welcome to the Taste Podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You're a depth observer of online culture, celebrity shenanigans, social media, and food, the consumed, cooked, and projected via social media channels type of food. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to know, what gets you excited about food culture today?
I like the fact that anyone can sort of just open a little tiny place and it can become a gigantic hit. If I lived in Portland, Oregon, I was just in Portland for my book tour, and I was just eating from truck to truck. I mean, that's a very developed truck culture. But I think my favorite place in New York last year was the Birrialandia taco truck, which is from Tijuana originally. The kind of food originates, and it's a beautiful, sloppy, wet taco that you dip into consomme. So, you know, you buy a taco, you buy a consomme, and even though your taco's sort of like falling apart because it's just brisket with just bathed in soup, and you're just dipping it into more soup, and I mean it's indecent.
Did you find that on TikTok? Because honestly, the birria trend was real on TikTok. It was a real thing.
I am not a ticker talker. I am on the gram, so I'm okay. You know, it takes me usually 10 years to find a trend. I just got rid of my MySpace.
Congratulations, Mazel.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I just you know, it's just there's nothing on it. But you can still find me at Hotmail, and you know, I was seeing it pop up on Instagram, and then I have a friend who's sort of like my bloodhound, and he spends the whole day just basically walking around the city eating. And he said, you got to go to Flushing. And I went, mm-hmm. Oh, it's so far. And then finally they opened a truck in Williamsburg. So I went across the river. I'm scared of subways because I'm claustrophobic. So when I have to get to the the boroughs from Manhattan, I take a ferry. And the ferry often drops me off right where the good food is, like Sunset Park and Astoria or LIC, Long Island City, or anything like that. So I've been hopping around, eating from places.
Did you ferry here? We're in Midtown Manhattan at the Penguin Random House offices.
I walked here. I live downtown, so I walked to Midtown. I try to also walk like 6 miles a day because I eat so much that if I don't walk for like 2.5 hours, it's not going to be good, you know.
So we met, I say met, quote, because we just met today face-to-face, but we emailed maybe like 6 years ago when you blurbed very kindly my cookbook, Koreatown.
Yeah, that was the tastiest book I've ever blurbed.
It was amazing. Thank you for that.
Sure.
And Our Country Friends has a real distinct Korean thread there. There's two main characters who are Korean.
Yeah.
And you write very vividly about Korean culture and Korean food. And I just wanted to know, like, from the jump, How do you bring this distinct Korean flavor to your writing, which you've had in many of your novels?
I am surrounded by Korean Americans. That friend I just mentioned, the bloodhound, the, you know, who goes around, he's Korean American. My wife's Korean American. My kid, I guess, is half Korean. My mentor, Chang-Rae Lee, the author of many great books, was Korean American. Two of my best friends. It just goes on and on. So I went to a high school that was very. There were a lot of kids from immigrant backgrounds like my own. I was born in Russia and the Soviet Union, and there were a lot of kids from Korea, India, China, etc. And so people were just sitting around eating kimbap, you know, which is a kind of lunch dish with rice and seaweed. It's like a roll, but it's very substantial, and you can stuff it with anything. I've had like foie gras kimbap somewhere.
Oh, over David, the Momofuku.
Yeah, Momofuku. That would be it. Yeah, yeah. And and when I go to Seoul, I have a lunch. You know, it's such a cheap but incredibly filling lunch. So, all that culture has always been marinating, kind of like the beef. and one of my favorite restaurants, which was in Koreatown, just closed recently, Marangusai, which, do you know that place? It's they did micro brisket. They did a kind of thick ribeye. It was really very delicious.
Sunwon Garden?
No, Marangusai. I think Chang-Rae or somebody, some Korean American took me there, and it was... They did a really great job. I was very sad that the pandemic killed them.
I didn't know that one. And
yeah.
What else do you like in 35 and 32 here in the city?
I think I like some of the stuff a little closer to me in downtown. Like I like Atomix is great.
Yeah.
I love Cote, the steakhouse.
Sure.
That's a really beautiful piece of beef. The last time I went to Seoul, this billionaire friend of mine took me out to like this pretty unassuming steakhouse, but it was like, you know, everyone, all the heads of the chaebol, the chaebols, they were all eating this really delicious steak that's been marinated in cognac for years, and you know, it was just acceptable.
Gary, that sounds rad, man.
Yeah, it really
cognac
was
marinated bulgogi or kalbi.
Yeah, kalbi bulgogi.
Yo, man.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just there last year in November. Mm-hmm. What a city. I feel like no one is writing about it vividly.
Yeah.
I feel like, what do you think? Will you set a novel there?
I would love to. I've written, so I did a piece a long time ago for Travel and Leisure when I kind of ate my way around Seoul. And then I did a really weird piece for the Smithsonian magazine where I researched robots in Korea. So I went from like one robot manufacturer to another but also ate my way through it too. I went to the opposite coast, you know, Incheon is on one coast and mm-hmm. I can't remember what the town was on the other side, but they
Pohang?
Maybe. That sounds kind of familiar. And crab was one of their specialties.
Yeah.
They had a lot of crab stuff, like a crab bibimbap, which was incredible.
Oh, yo, that sounds good. I feel like Seoul will have its Tokyo moment.
Yeah, I hope so.
At some time.
Yeah, yeah. You know, because it's kind of it's a huge city, obviously. I mean, so is Tokyo, but it's the subway connects it really, the metro connects it really nicely. You can be anywhere in 20 minutes, you know, because it's such a fast, wonderful subway, so you can really eat your way through that town, too. And the great food stands, too. So
your character, Ed, who is Korean-American or Korean, I'm unsure if it's...
Korean-Korean.
Korean-Korean, right.
But he has British, UK, UK, Swiss, and Canadian citizenship.
That's right.
He's a real citizen of the world. Yeah.
A real slasher, yeah. But Ed has this amazing line. The world needs another Mediterranean cookbook like I need another ulcer. It's so fun. I wonder, do you believe personally in that sentiment? And then the second part is, what is the cookbook that we do need?
So here's the thing, and I'll be completely blunt. I eat like a maniac. You know, if you follow me on Instagram, at Steinger, or Twitter, or anything, all I'm doing is eating, you know. And then I walk 6 miles or I swim for 2 hours to try to keep some of that weight off. But that's all I do. But I do not know how to freaking cook. At all. I don't know how to boil water. Last time I did, you know, the water exploded somehow. I caused like a Chernobyl type thing in my kitchen and everything was, you know, and it's funny, upstate where I spent half the year, we have a chef used to own the house. So there's this like incredible, I don't know how many burner range with 12 burners.
12? Okay.
I can't even count them. I don't know. There's a lot of burners. I don't know what the hell's going on. There's all these buttons. It's like airplane cockpit to the baking oven. You can put an entire pig in there or something. but it's completely lost on me. And my wife thankfully cooks a little bit, but you know, we're all very busy, so there's a lot of, in New York I just eat out all the time, but upstate we do sometimes cook for Christmas or something for friends, and so we'll put, you know, throw in a pig or a moose or
feel though that you have a sense of the cookbook world? Like, I mean, I know you're not a home cook, but you write books.
And I do. No, I mean, you know, I enjoyed your book quite a bit. I enjoyed another book, and I recently ate there in Portland, Kachka, which is an amazing, you know, Russian food. Look, I'll be honest, it's not my favorite food, even though I grew up there. It's not very spicy. It's kind of, everything's boiled and kind of a lot of sour cream and butter. It's not my favorite, but they do an incredible job, kind of hipster Russian cuisine, really great. And they wrote a very funny kind of book also, you know, going at one of their, you know, just like in your book, somebody has some of the heritages from there and they get to contribute. So I do love to read those books. Like I can read them, you know, and they're fun, but there's got to be a narrative to it too. So it's not just, you know, oh, now we're going to cook this, or we're going to cook that. But my wife is a really good cook, so I often buy her cookbooks. For me, the more interesting stuff is sort of, if I were to attempt cooking, it would be, I guess I would go to like the Mark Bittman land. He also lives upstate.
Down in Cold Spring.
Cold Spring, right. So he's a little bit south of me, but I'm more in the Rhinebeckian.
You're in the Rhinebeck land. I live upstate as well in Orange County.
Yeah.
So we can debate who has the better food.
It's funny. There used to be like a lot of, east, you know, like East Coast, West Coast. It was like east side of the river, west side of the river. But even now I admit that Kingston right now has the best food scene. And that's a town of about 26,000 people, and a lot of Brooklynites have fled there, to the point where when I was getting my license renewed during the pandemic, this woman came out and was like, in the DMV, and was like, no Brooklyn people.
It's funny how Kingston does have incredible bakery, and pizza up there is very good.
The pizza's good. Lola's Pizzeria is great if you try that. And they also, the Kinsley, the Hotel Kinsley has a beautiful restaurant.
I don't know.
And food is really spectacular.
Well, this is an endorsement for Kingston and paid for by the Kingston Tourism
Board. The Kingston Bureau of Eatings.
Speaking of, you're not a home cook, but you can write food scenes beautifully.
Yes.
And I want to call out the Tonado and Snap scene.
Yes.
I really, anybody, I hope our listeners have read your book, Our Country Friends.
It's worth it just for that recipe.
The recipe, so is this scene based on any kind of recipe? Because it's written in a way that clearly you cooked it once when you were writing.
I didn't cook it, but a good friend of mine cooked it. So I often, Our Country Friends, the conceit is that this Russian writer, where'd I come up with that, right?
Yeah.
He has all his friends who are all fleeing the pandemic during the start in March 2020. They all come up to his house and everyone takes turns cooking dinner and stuff like that. So, and I do something similar. I have, during the summer, I invite a lot of my friends from the city to come up. And I have a lot of friends who live there full time, but everyone kind of takes turns grilling or cooking. And so my friend, James Beluyet, who is a rock musician with a band, used to be in a band called Versus. Now I think it's the Plus Minus Band.
Mm.
Really great band.
Versus rules, man.
Yeah, Versus rules,
what
right?
What a great band.
It's a great band.
Oh,
yeah,
damn.
Yeah.
Nice reference.
Nice reference, right. Yeah, so I've known him way back in the day when I think Versus, it was still called Versus. And so I invited him up a couple of years ago, and he made this incredible vitello tonnato, which I love. But he used, you know, snap peas, which I didn't know. And I think he said he got the recipe from somewhere else. But it was so exceptional. And when the book came out as a promotional thing, I had the a wonderful writer from New York Times, the book review, Alexandra Alter. She came up with her husband, and I invited my friend James up. And he made that exact thing. And a lot of people also made the exact recipes for this article for the New York Times.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. And I feel even if you're reading this in winter when snap peas aren't in season, I'm like going to go find some snap peas.
Yeah. And we actually, there's wonderful food stands all over upstairs, you know, so we would buy the snap peas and then we would get, and also grilled sardines. He makes these really beautiful. I don't know how he just grills them perfectly. That's a delicious, you know, an underrated fish. And actually one thing I eat that I know how to make because I just open a can is there's all kinds of Portuguese really high-end sardine makers. And they make them in spices and hot vegetable oil. Oof, really delicious. So that, you know, I open up that, I toast up a piece of bread. I know how to do that. I put out some beautiful color, you know.
It's more curating, olives. Right?
Than it's more cooking. Curating, exactly. Yeah. Cooking. I know how to curate.
Yeah. I have to shout out my colleague Anna Heasel, senior editor at Taste. She is writing a book about conservas and tinned fish.
So I love conservas and tinned fish. And there's a great place, you know, in New York called Huertas.
Yes, yes, of course.
On 1st and 6th are around there. Beautiful, really sweet owners and chef and everything. And it's partly, I mean, it's around, they do other kinds of dishes too, but you can have a whole meal of beautiful cockles and mussels and sardines and whatever. It's just beautiful.
Speaking of collecting, you write very vividly about your bar, you know, the bar at the house in the novel.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I like that you have your protagonist mixing Negronis with 60-year Campari, 60-year-old. Is that intentionally like this guy doesn't know what he's doing, or do you actually have a moment? Do you believe that this is the best way to make a Negroni?
Look, I have people who, when they come by, everyone brings a bottle of something, and a lot of my friends bring really special stuff.
Sure.
You know, from all over the world. We have a French friend who lives nearby, and her parents are in wine country, but they make their own gin, and they bottle it. And it's unlike any other gin I've ever, and I love making martinis, and I just couldn't bring myself to make anything with them. I just drink this gin straight up, nothing else. It is the elixir of the gods. It's so beautiful. But yeah, people bring all this stuff, and I'm like, oh my God, what do I do with antique Campari? Probably I should just drink it by, make something.
I love that you have antique Campari on hand. That's just the best thing.
It's all gone by now, but it existed at one point. Now I'm like slowly going through this gin. And, but I know that people will always surprise me, and people come from all over. You know, people do their travels. Well, this has stopped during the pandemic, but before people would be like, oh, I just, somebody just brought me, I was on tour when I was reading in San Francisco, and I love anything Georgian. There's a great Georgian restaurant in my part of Manhattan.
Yeah. What's it called?
It's called Chito Gavrito. I can't remember where it is exactly, but somewhere near Union Square. And it's, these aubergine rolls and this garlicky chicken they do, a whole hen. Just incredible. So this guy who's just, you know, he reads my books, and he brought me homemade chacha, which is a kind of Georgian brandy, C-H-A-C-H-A. And it was so freaking good. And I realized I was, you know, I had to wake up the next morning. And I forgot that I had it, and then the dude in the airport is like,
nice.
It's like 7 a.m. I had an early flight to Portland. He's like, you can't, you know, you gotta check in your luggage. And I was like, there's no time, so I just drank the whole freaking bottle.
Wow.
And I think I had like a NPR interview or something later that day, and I'm like, let me tell you about my book.
I'll definitely link to that interview in the show notes.
You can find it. Yeah. Oh my God.
I love it.
It's great.
I feel like this book, it has a lot of time traveling happening. And one of the wonderful parts of the aspects of the book, Our Country Friends, is the flashbacks of New York in the 90s, New York City. And I get to shout out to Screaming Mimi's. That's a great reference. But
thank you.
One of the best references is Florent. You write about Florent as a meatpacking institution from the 80s until, I would say, 2014, maybe 2010. I might be wrong. Let's talk about Florent, because clearly you have a connection to the place.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. It was such an eye-opener for me. You know, I grew up in Eastern Queens, Little Neck, Queens, you know, which is, it might as well be the suburbs, kind of this very, it's far away. There's not even a subway there. You have to take the Long Island Railroad to get into town. And it was a very provincial, I went to this kind of parochial Jewish school, right? I didn't even know what Manhattan was. Like, for a while, I confused some of the tall buildings in Queens for Manhattan. I just didn't know where, you know. And then I got into this high school in Manhattan, this kind of math and science high school, where I met all of my friends, some of whom are, you know, composites for some of the characters in Our Country Friends. So, and that was Manhattan. That was a lower, East Village, Lower East Side kind of place. And it was incredible. And along the way, I think right after school ended, I discovered Florent. And it was a trip. First of all, the food was really good.
Always.
Really
good. Always
good.
It was never bad. I mean, that's the one thing about this restaurant. It was
never
always
bad.
Good.
Never bad. You could buy a carafe of white wine for, I think, $6, right? Which I know was more then, right? But still, you know, whatever. Can you imagine a $10 carafe today? And mussels with fries, this incredible... what was it? Oh, it was like a goat cheese spinach. Again, remember, I was from nowhere from Hickland. And for me, this kind of, you know, cheap French food, please. But it was also the fact that it stayed open almost entirely through the night. And it was filled with denizens that I had never, ever imagined in my life. You know, every artist went down there. Every writer went down there. There were prostitutes, transgender prostitutes, who used to ply their trade along Little West 12th.
Yeah, Village Idiot, right on that stretch.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so they would drop in at 3 in the morning after finishing their, I guess, shift, or before a new shift began. And, you know, and it was the most democratic place in New York. And that's the kind of stuff I really miss now that Manhattan. And that's one of the reasons I really enjoy living upstate. Not that we have that exactly, but it feels a lot certainly more democratic than the New York of today. I mean, you really have to go to, you know, to find a taco truck in Queens or Brooklyn if you want to, or the Bronx if you want to find something like that today. But the Florent was just, and it was a beautiful kind of, you know, it had a chrome bar. There was a kind of a letterboard.
It had a zinc bar.
Zinc bar, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sorry, zinc bar. It had a kind of letterboard where there would be funny writings. The owner was this wonderfully flamboyant dude. You know, he was a French guy. His name was Florent. It was probably the most perfect restaurant in the world. And when it closed, I remember I went there the night before it closed.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Oh, wow.
I did. I was doing a reading in Israel, of all places, and I was like, put me on the flight. I got to get back in time for it. And it was so depressing, honestly. And I think for me, Manhattan really lost a lot of its luster after.
It was the meatpacking district before Restoration Hardware, before a lot of that bullshit that made that neighborhood soulless.
It's soulless. I'm sorry to offend people who live there, but
I will.
Okay, go ahead. I mean, it's one of my most disliked neighborhoods.
Yeah, me
ever.
Too.
I go there for the Apple Store, and it's like, that's right. That's where you go for like high end electronic crap. Not anything. I haven't eaten there in ages. Oh, you know, Pastis reopened. That's okay, but you know, I wish they would move somewhere else.
Yeah. Do you remember when Tom Brown used to hang out at Pastis like every single morning?
Yeah.
He would be at the Pastis had a real vibe too, similar to Florent like years later.
Yeah, yeah. Pastis sort of picked up the baton from Florent in a way, but it was never like it.
But I just think, are there any other restaurants from 90s New York that you want to remember? I think our audience would appreciate that.
So there were a bunch actually not far from the Meatpacking District. And I used to live around that area. I used to live on 11th and, I can't remember where, Greenwich probably. Yeah, Greenwich and 11th around there. So there was a great place on Jane around there called El Faro. And I think I've written about that in other books I've written, because it was a real kind of a Spanish place. Everybody used to smoke inside. The walls were these kind of murals of scenes from Galicia. It was the Galician cuisine. So mariscada in green sauce, like thick and garlic, or shrimp al ajillo, and just everything was, I mean, the salad had garlic on it. The tablecloth had garlic on it, you know. You walked out of there and you would smell like garlic for the rest of your life, and smoke, because people would smoke while eating.
What a wonderful bouquet there. The garlic breath and the cigarette.
And I remember, like, people go on dates. I would make out with people after smoking and eating there. I don't know how the hell, because it didn't matter at that point. You know, everyone smelled like a garlic ashtray. Just delicious, delicious food. Yeah. Another place, what the hell was it called? Rio Mar, which was right down the street from Florent. In one of those sort of triangular buildings, beautiful buildings, also Spanish food, specializing obviously in seafood. I think the biggest roach I've ever seen in New York on the wall there. It looked like one of the lobsters had escaped. For a second, I was like, huh? Get him back in the tank. And then he flew away, and I was like, oh.
Oh, my God. I'll even shout out the old Fatty Crab that was
Fatty
over
Crab!
It. Remember Fatty Crab?
I remember Fatty Crab. I think one of the owners of Fatty Crab, I don't know how this works. I think they have a place in Hudson, which is another great food town upstate, called Back Bar.
Zach Palaccio.
Oh, that's it.
Zach Palaccio, hopefully one day will be on the podcast. Old acquaintance of mine. Good guy. Good guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's behind that, right?
Yeah.
So that's a great place. And they do a kind of, they do all of the cuisines of Southeast Asia, which can be a disaster, obviously.
Yeah.
But everything has a very specific taste, and everything is as spicy as it should be. So highly recommend.
When handled in the right hands, like Southeast Asian cuisine, my goodness.
Yeah.
it's the best.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your travels, because you referenced some travel writing you've done and a lot of travel for your book tours and your mm-hmm. work. Mm-hmm. Where do you like to travel for the food? I know this question seems boring, but I feel like I want to just, where does your mind go when I ask you this kind of basic question?
I used to be a contributing, when I was younger, I used to be a contributing editor to Travel and Leisure.
Ooh, with like good expense accounts
era? With the greatest expense accounts, because this was when Amex owned it.
Yes.
Something called Meredith, I think, owns it now.
Oh, so they gave you like a black or something?
They didn't give me a card, but there was, you know, I remember at one point flying business on Cathay Pacific to Hong Kong, staying at the Peninsula, not just in any room, but in the telescope suite, where there's this giant telescope that looks out into the skyline from Kowloon, where, you know, and then having a Rolls Royce Phantom drive me to the airport. I mean, it was bananas. You know, I was like 30 years old. I'm like, this is life? Wow. And it's all been downhill from there, obviously. But food was a huge concentration for me. So I think some of the cities I enjoyed most, Bangkok for sure. I mean, another one of those cities where you walk around, people are selling you, you know, hot soup in plastic bags and you drink through a straw. I mean, you know, you just kind of, another great city for ferries. You can take a ferry and hop around from, you know, from pier to pier, and there's great food just walking a couple of blocks inland. Bombay is incredible, and I went there with a friend of mine, Suketu Mehta, who's a great eater and wrote Bombay Maximum City, a great Pulitzer finalist of a book about Bombay. So he knew where all the, you know, so we were both eating really well and being chased by gangsters and stuff. It was like
your trip.
It was a full tilt kind of adventure. Beijing has great food. I think Asia, Seoul, obviously, as I mentioned a piece on Seoul. Asia to me has some of the best food out there right now. In terms of America, I think Memphis is an incredible and underrated food for barbecue.
Yeah.
I love a good barbecue.
Beale Street's got some spots. Mm-hmm, and then mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of good dry rub barbecue up there. Yeah.
Really good. And a lot of it is like not in downtown, far from downtown.
Yeah,
so
you have to Uber
around. And it's always, I think there's one called A&R or something. Mm-hmm. It's in the middle of nowhere. I've never had anything so delicious. You know, and it's like $2 or something. It's ridiculous. But
nice, Gary. Really great incredible. Pick from Memphis. That was unexpected. I love that pick. Great
one. Memphis is really great. I mean, the South in general is pretty damn good. I would definitely put Memphis on the map. Yeah.
Do you want to break from fiction and get into some travelogue?
Yes.
Is that?
I would love to. Are you kidding me? I would love to have my own like travel show or something. Yeah. You know. I remember at one point we pitched it to some travel channel, but they were like, I had a bad pitch. I wanted to, I think it was going to call the Annoyed Traveler or something. It was like me moping around because I didn't get bumped up to business or something. And they're like, yeah, maybe not. But like just a food trip, that would be incredible because I eat like a mother.
I feel you could take Tucci on. I feel like you could take him on. We aren't starting controversies here, don't worry.
Yeah.
I would love for you to host a show or some kind of meet. I just enjoy your travel writing written for Sephora. I enjoy it.
Thank
so.
You. I enjoy writing it more than anything, honestly.
So I want to ask you about the bungalow colony you grew up you grew up going to. It is in Ellenville.
It was in Ellenville. Yeah. Do you know Ellenville? Have you been there?
So I was going to ask you about Cohen's Bakery.
Oh yeah.
Did you ever go there and have the corn rye at Cohen's?
No, we didn't. And it was the reason was, well, first of all, we didn't really know much about Ellenville. When we went to Ellenville, we went to one place only. There was a kind of it was like a Dairy Queen setup, but it wasn't Dairy Queen. It was like an off-brand Dairy Queen.
And Dairy King, probably.
Dairy King. Dairy Princess.
Yeah.
It was so we went there and then we went to the supermarket. We were also all really like recent immigrants, nobody spoke English well, and we had, we couldn't afford anything, you know. I remember, like, when we went out to Ponderosa Steakhouse, like, that was a big thing, or Sizzlers, you know. And I remember we'd go there, and we would all stock up, you know, our grandparents would be putting tomatoes into their purses to, you know, to try to steal them, and because we were like, whoa, $6.99, we got to make this
buffet
last.
Culture, you know, buffet is real, culture, man.
It's real. So we didn't, I don't think we, but there was a woman who drove around in this station wagon, this gigantic like AMC or something station wagon, and she would sell, she was this big woman, and she would scream, breads, cakes, all across the bungalow colony, and all these Russians would come out for a quarter. You could buy a Danish for 50 cents. You could buy like a
what a cool memory.
Croissant. Yeah, and so I wrote about this in a memoir called Little Failure, and all of a sudden this guy wrote in and said, I think that was my mom. And he said we had a difficult relationship, I think, and she had issues and stuff. And that was very interesting because to us, she was like the bringer of bread.
She was the baker. Well, I have to say, in Ellenville today, there's a bakery called Cohen's Bakery. Cohen's. Ellenville is on the way to Kerhonkson over the hill up in the Catskills. And I feel like it is the best Jewish bakery in New York State.
Wow.
And the corn rye that they're making is insane. It is so good. It is the most deeply flavorful bread. And it has a texture. I think good rye has that that velvety texture,
yeah, I love
right?
A good rye.
Good rye. It's corn rye. So I was just wondering if you've been up there. I highly recommend it.
I'm going to go for sure. I actually was, and there's a restaurant there that people have been talking about. I hope it didn't close. Aroma or something. Aroma something. I don't know if you've ever tried it. I would love to try both. Go to the bakery and the restaurant.
I've not been to Rome. I've heard about it, but I know there's some cool things in Ellenville, a very small little town, and it has
a great little
theater there, though.
Yeah, the theater. So what is the theater now? Movies or is it plays?
It's a stage. It's a summer stock.
It's a stage.
Yeah.
Oh, because I think it was at one point a movie theater because I remember seeing Octopussy there and being so wowed by that. I think it was my first Bond.
Oh, there
film.
Is a movie theater. Of course, there's a movie theater there, and it's an old two-screener. Wonderful little
stuff. Yeah.
Oh,
really
yeah.
Great stuff. Like a quarter for popcorn back in the day. Oh, my God. I had such great memories.
I'm glad we're talking about TV and film because you write for Succession, and you also just praised Yellow Jackets, which...
I should preface by saying I've done some stuff for Succession. I'm not like one of the main writers, but I did work on the second season.
Error, not yours, because that was clear when I prepped. It was you're a consultant on Succession.
Yeah.
So I guess what draws you to this TV work, and in terms of the TV work, do you write food scenes? Because you have such this grasp of food writing.
Yeah. I mean, I do. I've never written a food scene. I hope to write a food scene. I find TV really, I'm a very dialogue-driven writer, so a lot of my books, just people talking over food, and, prestige TV is all about people talking over food, sometimes in a private jet, but that's the, that's Succession, really. They're all just talking and drinking and making snide remarks over really overpriced food, and I would love to write a food scene. Shows like Billions have great food scenes. They often call out great New York eating spots. I think the people that write for that are big foodies.
Yeah. So, the creator is clearly a foodie.
The creator's a huge foodie. Yeah, absolutely. Koppelman, right?
Yeah. Brian Koppelman. Yeah. He's definitely like hanging out with a lot of food writers. And I like, obviously, TV that has like a real understanding of food and not just a superficial, resonates with like 98% of the population.
Yeah. And, on that note, I love hanging out with food critics. I just recently had drinks with Adam Platt at Pastis, actually.
Oh, cool.
And he's really great. He's got a nice kind of... a no BS kind of attitude toward restaurants in New York. I remember Pete Wells, whose critiques I love. I remember having dinner with him too. So there's some really, really delicious writers out there.
I love, you can learn a lot from a food critic. And on this show, just going to shout out, we've had interviews with Bill Addison at the LA Times, Ruth Reuschel, former New York Times, LA Times.
Sure.
Pete Wells previously.
Oh, yeah. Pete. Yeah, that's that who I said?
Or? Yeah, Pete. Yeah,
Pete,
we've had him
the
all
best.
On the Taste podcast. And
Pete's
we and Robert Sitzema. So.
Oh, I love his stuff.
He's
too.
Great. And you can learn
love
a lot.
Stuff.
From the critics.
Love his stuff. Yeah.
We ask all of our guests on the Taste podcast, if there was a book that you could write, a cookbook, let's just say cookbook, Gary, without a budget or time or even a deadline, what would that cookbook be?
Wow, that's a really tough one. I feel like if it existed, maybe it already exists. Does Russ and Daughters have a cookbook?
Ooh, don't quote me on it. I'm going to say they've got such great branding. They must have a cookbook.
See, this is the thing. So if they have one, then that kind of destroys any need for a cookbook for me because that kind of cook, because they're incredible in that they have an amazing drinks list, one of the best drinks list. I mean, their mixology is second to none.
It's a cool place.
I love, because the Russian idea of food is you're basically... It's all about zakuski, which is sort of the appetizer. I mean, the main dishes kind of suck, if you ask me. Sorry, all the Russians out there. But it's the, you're sitting around, little bits of herring on pumpernickel toast or sturgeon or sable or any one of these wonderful fishes. You put it in a blini, you put it on some kind of rye or some kind of peasant bread, some pickles, and then you mix it with incredible drinks, right? And that's all you need, So if that's what I like to serve people. That's my contribution when when my friends make dinners, you know, and they cook these very complex, you know, my friend Suketu makes beautiful Gujarati vegan dishes or vegetarian dishes. And my, you know, my friend James makes that incredible vitello. And I will make, I will open up some beautiful Russian daughter sardines, slap them on pumpernickel bread and get some incredible vodka into the mix. And,
I think a little bit of vodka goes a long way.
It really does.
And Gary Steingart, thank you for joining us on
today's
podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Appreciate it.
The Taste Podcast is hosted by Matt Rodbard and me, Anna Heasel. The show is produced by Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. Our theme music is by Steve Rydell. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com and make sure to subscribe to our newsletter. Thanks for listening.